My name is Steve Westgarth, and this is The Engineering Leader. Today on The Engineering Leader, I'm joined by Mo Salci, a Director of Engineering at GSK, where he works as part of my team focused on building core platform capabilities and web propositions, predominantly within the MERN tech stack. Mo, it's a pleasure to have you on The Engineering Leader today.
Thanks for having me.
Before we begin, could I just confirm that you also write bad code?
Bad? I mean, terrible code.
And Mo, to be fair, I've seen your code. I know how bad it is. let's start by getting you to tell us a bit about yourself. How did you get to where you are today?
I guess my journey starts back when I was in high school. I just had a bit of a passion for building websites, so I was building static websites in school. Just for fun. I remember a website I built for an estate agent just to get them to modernize. And then I kind of went into the industry. So I started building, as part of teams, building e-commerce sites for the likes of M&S, ASOS, Boots UK. And that brought me here to GSK, where I'm leading our MERN chapter.
You know, I think it's amazing how many people have started in the same sort of places as both, actually you and I have, because I mean, when I was at school, I also just started randomly playing with tech and building websites. I remember when I was doing my A-levels, I got the opportunity to create a school intranet, because that's what the school needed. And I was playing with classic ASP and just using online tutorials to kind of work out how to do things. And at that time, I didn't really understand how the technology worked. It just took a bit of, you know, a bit of guesswork and a bit of your time and trial and error to kind of see what happened. How do you think that you got to a point where you actually knew what good code looked like? Because, you know, if you have never been shown that, how do you know what's good?
No, generally, it's, I remember when I was back at school and all we were doing were really kind of content changes or small structural changes. And generally, it was just, it works, that's amazing. I mean, the thing that I wrote has actually changed something that hundreds of people are looking at, and I guess slowly when you work with people in teams, you read blogs and articles, etc., you actually start to see actually what you've written is pretty bad. I mean, it's actually pretty terrible, and I think I kind of challenged myself a little bit. I'd go back 6 months and constantly looked at my code 6 months ago and thought, wow, I mean, I'd never write that now. And just through experience, through years of kind of working with other people and reading things, I mean, you do get to a really, really good place. But it's all about kind of always improving and always investing in yourself.
I think that's right. I mean, I think if you look back at what you did, you know, 6 months ago, I mean, what anybody did 6 months ago, if you haven't improved, then, you know, that's a problem, right? I mean, everybody kind of improves naturally as we kind of go through things. And sometimes actually reminding yourself how far you've come in such a short space of time, it's a really powerful thing. Because I think, you know, as humans, as individuals, we're really hard on ourselves at times. It's easy to kind of think, actually, no, we're doing rubbish. We aren't achieving anything. But actually just kind of looking back and reminding yourself, you know, where you've actually come from and where you've got to, and not judging yourself against anybody else, you know, making sure you're judging you against you, because you're on your own journey, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's the same in all industries. I mean, you don't expect a doctor who's just graduated out of university to go straight into heart surgery alone. It's all constant developing and improving yourself and experience and figuring out what you've done wrong before and improving yourself as you go along.
So you've obviously come to work at GSK. I think listeners will know, because I've mentioned it before, that GSK are on a really interesting journey at the moment as we look to divest consumer healthcare into a brand new company called Haleon, which actually launches on the 18th of next month. What makes you want to work in healthcare tech?
So I think I've previously worked in a lot of e-commerce sites, and I think when I started at Boots and COVID, I think it was a real journey for me. I remember landing in Boots and when COVID hit, I was working in the pharmacy side of things. And what we were doing where we were developing apps to deliver prescription items directly to patients. So there were vulnerable patients, elderly patients at times, who weren't able to go to the store anymore to pick up their prescriptions or weren't able to go to their local pharmacies. And suddenly what I was doing, the work I was doing, allowed vulnerable members of society to be able to get their prescription items delivered to their house. And pretty much, it allowed them to stay alive, if I put it that way. And it just made me realize why wouldn't you want to work in healthcare and deliver something that really makes a difference to people? And I think I look at what I'm working on now with in GSK. So we're creating this app called My Pharmacist, and it's all about actually how can we better connect patients to their local healthcare providers. And it just I just have a real passion for it now.
I think it's it's something I share with you. I think that, you know, there's something about a higher purpose, about, you know, why we're actually working in the industry. And, you know, I did a lot of inflection around, you know, kind of, you know, where I wanted to work and what I wanted to do. And, you know, my reason for joining Boots when I joined Boots, several years ago was very similar. You know, it was about, you know, this idea that I was helping one of the nation's most loved brands and actually kind of, you know, doing something which was bigger than just the tech. And I have thought about working in different industries. You know, I looked at, you know, kind of, you know, the financial sector. You know, there's a lot of stuff happening in fintech at the moment, which is quite interesting, and in various other sectors. But I think for me, you know, it is that higher purpose. You know, what more, what better thing could you do than help somebody have great health? You know, that's a real powerful thing, to actually have a direct and meaningful impact on people's lives. And I think the more and more engineers I talk to, you know, more people are kind of having that kind of view that actually, you know, this is not just about writing any old software or kind of, you know, churning out code. This is about having impact, and I think that's so important.
Yeah, and I think genuinely, I talk to members of my community, etc. And generally, I'm very, very proud of actually the impact I'm having on society and making a difference. And I think we should do more of that from the tech industry.
So I guess that, you know, that there is quite a shortage of engineers. There's a lot of talk around, you know, how few engineers we've got available in the industry. I've had the privilege this week of being at MongoDB World, and Mark Porter, who's the CTO at MongoDB, as part of his keynote mentioned that analysts are now saying that in the US alone, by 2025, we'll be 400,000 engineers short of the demands that industry needs. Do you think there's something about the industry responding and actually helping your people to see the impact that engineers can have by coming into the industry that might actually encourage new people who maybe weren't thinking about engineering, or school leavers who weren't thinking about this as a potential career, to come and get involved and create some great product?
Yeah, I think there's two levels here. I think one, there's a big degree of underrepresentation in tech, and we know that. I think there's big programs going out from different organizations to try to bring those people in. And I think we definitely, there's more work needed there. But I think if you look back at the time when we were in school, very, very few engineers actually came to talk to us at school or come and teach school students. I mean, I think about myself now, and actually I have quite a lot of expertise. I mean, if I was to give 2 hours of my week away to teach school kids around coding and technology, it's better to have somebody who's in industry going in and starting at grassroots rather than expecting school leavers to then pick it up later on in life.
I think you're right. I mean, there's a lot of talk about your graduate programs, but actually for me, I think that that is almost too late. You know, we as an industry need to be engaging, you know, with school age kids who are, you know, coming through the system, and helping them to see and understand, you know, what can be achieved if you're by coming into the tech industry. And I think that's true of all groups as well. I mean, you know, by the time you get into industry, I mean, we are in a very male dominated industry, and there's a lot of talk about how we can get more women in tech, and that we've made a lot of strides in that space, but still, you know, the numbers are very, very imbalanced. But actually, when you look at the results that girls get coming out of GCSE or coming through A level, actually they outperform boys at every level. So, you know, it's really interesting what happens, that, you know, you kind of get to university or kind of get out of school. Where does that flip go, and why is it that, you know, that lots of women don't choose to come into this industry? And a few years ago, I went to WWDC, and Michelle Obama was talking. I think this was WWDC 2017, if you want to look back at the various videos. And, you know, she was talking about this. I mean, you were looking at a room of maybe 5,000-6,000 people that were attending Apple's Dub. And, you know, you could probably, I'm exaggerating, but count on one hand the number of women that were actually in the room. And she was making the really valid point that is our problem as an industry, right? You know, you can't blame women for saying, you know, well, why aren't you coming into the industry? We need to inflect upon the industry and say, you know, what is wrong with the industry that, you know, that is saying that, you know, we aren't welcoming and open to actually get women and girls into tech. And it's something that, you know, I'm very passionate about, and you think that your other organisations need to be too. What more can we do as an industry, Mo?
No, I think you're absolutely right, and I think it does go back to, I mean, if we're not going in at grassroots, if we're not going into schools as engineers and showing students just how cool tech is. I mean, how would they know? We expect them to make their own decisions and go and study computer science at university and then go and apply for a grad scheme. But by then, it's just way too late. It's all about actually how do we as organizations allow our engineers to go in and give back to the community? And I think that's the only way we're going to solve the problem with shortage and the problem with underrepresentation.
And one of the ways that we're going to get, you know, really cool people to come and work in the tech industry is by working with really cool tech, right? Now, you're a really enthusiastic JavaScript developer. So tell us, why is JavaScript so great?
I mean, yeah, as you know, JavaScript is amazing for many reasons. I was talking to a colleague of mine the other day who doesn't code a script, and I gave him six different points around why I think JavaScript is the way to go. I think the first thing is JavaScript is the only programming language that can be understood by a web browser. So many, many years ago, some developers decided they needed a language that a browser can understand. And that language was JavaScript. I mean, if you look at Java, Ruby, Python, C, they all need a server. And the server then needs to wrap the code in a way the browser can understand it. JavaScript is different. It's understood natively by the browser. So I'd say that's point number one. I think point number two is if you look at big organizations, so the likes of Twitter, Facebook, Gmail, Netflix, PayPal, they all use JavaScript extensively, and there's reasons for it. And even, I mean, if you look at Facebook, they've invested in their own JavaScript framework. So, I mean, if you're looking to get into tech now, whether you're coming in as a school leaver or whether you're changing from a different programming language, there's great career opportunities. I'd say that's number two. The third thing is, I think JavaScript can be used absolutely everywhere, and we've seen recently that there are JavaScript frameworks to write cross-platform applications, mobile applications. Now, I probably wouldn't use that for big organizations, but if I wanted to get a proof of concept up and running, or wanted to prove that actually what my my idea kind of worth going away with, then I'd probably just, I could do everything in JavaScript. Then again, I'd probably mention cross-platform applications. They don't have some of the functionality that you'll get natively, so offline mode, etc. So I'd have that with a bit of a caveat. I think it will get there. It's not there now. So that's another point. The other thing I'd say is JavaScript, because it works on the web, you're able to automate your day-to-day workflows. So anything that you find repetitive, and you're seeing a lot of apps do that for calendars, etc. I mean, they purely use JavaScript. So that's point number four. Point number five, I'd say the massive online developer community for JavaScript makes it just kind of second to none. JavaScript's been the most commonly used language for nearly 10 years in a row now. I mean, we all heard of ECMAScript 2015, ES6. It really wasn't very long ago. But because of the massive community, we now have ES7, ES8, ES9, ES10, ES11, ES12. I mean, they've all been released since. And I mean, I was using GitHub Copilot the other day, and I mean, you generally, a lot of code has just been written for you. And I think the last point I'd make on that is it's just such a super fast language. I mean, those who don't understand the language will tell you it's an interpreted language, so it's slow, but it's got the just-in-time compiler, which makes it kind of second to none as a language.
And Mo, to hear you talk, you would literally wonder why anybody was developing in any other language, right? I mean, I think we need to, you know, we forget Java, forget Python, forget C, forget Swift. They all need to go away. Let's all focus on JavaScript, right? Surely there must be some downsides. Tell me some downsides.
So JavaScript's very, very easy to learn. And I think I mentioned that in my points earlier. And you can even write your code directly into the browser and figure out what it does. But it is very, very expressive. So you can have two engineers solving the same problem in completely different ways. And what that causes is it causes big problems for big organizations when they're using JavaScript, because you can have a common language set, but then have engineers won't be able to jump from one project to another because things are so different. And it's all about, if you are going down the JavaScript route, it's very, very important to have some principles, patterns, and standards kind of set about. It's very important to be using things like ESLint. It's very important to make sure that you have kind of common pipelines where you can definitely use TypeScript. I'd say those are the main things that you need to be aware of.
And I think that's something that we spend a lot of time talking about in work, don't we, around, you know, how we can ensure that engineers are, you know, developing in a way that is enterprise friendly, and we're building out applications that actually we are going to be able to support and maintain because we've established those patterns, principle, standards. And it becomes increasingly important when you have federated engineering teams. So both at Boots and GSK, we have a world where we have a core engineering capability, but we also have your other teams in other parts of the organization that we need to support, that want to come and develop software for us. And I think that's recognizing that, you know, because of the scale and size of these organizations, your one team can't possibly do everything. So it's about how you set the guardrails for those people kind of coming on board. But that's so difficult, right? Especially when you've got your new people kind of coming into the organization. You maybe haven't worked with us before. How do you get the message out there? How do you let people see, you know, look, this is the way we do things around here?
So it's actually very easy. It's if you have a common pipeline, for example, that everybody uses. So you'll run various things in your pipeline. So you'll run unit test coverage. So to check that your unit tests are, for example, at 80, 90% or 100%, if you're being a purist, you're running linting to make sure that actually code is written in a very, very similar way across the organization. You run kind of your end-to-end tests. So end-to-end tests, again, you can write them in JavaScript. So it's very important to run those. I mean, kind of getting you can almost have so many different projects running at the same time, on the same website, and still be in a CI/CD model. as long as you're set up in the right way with the same principles, patterns, and standards. And it's all about making people aware of actually how the pipelines run, what's the way to deploy, and what are our principles, patterns, and standards. I mean, we invest quite heavily in our documentation. We make sure that actually, if you are going to open a new project, all the documentation is there for everybody to see. But I think if everybody is connecting to the same pipeline in the first place, then actually it's, you won't be able to release anything or not adhere to the standards, unless you've ticked all the boxes.
So a lot of big enterprises have historically invested, particularly in Java, actually, you know, as the language that they've chosen to build their big enterprise systems in. And you know, many enterprises may say that Java is therefore a superior language. It's more enterprise friendly. How would you respond to that?
So there's a famous saying which says anything that can be written in JavaScript will eventually be written in JavaScript. I mean, it's all about simplicity and ubiquity, right? So I think hands down, if you want to build a REST API today, you can build it in JavaScript in less than 30 minutes. I mean, in JavaScript, you have this big, bulky IDE that you're going to have to build and maintain, etc. With Node.js and JavaScript, I mean, you just use the Express framework, which is just an NPM package. And all you need is a text editor and you're good to go. And it's, if you look at the architecture for Node.js, event-driven architecture, it runs on the really, really fast V8 engine. There might be a use case to use Java for very, very specific things. But I think overall, I'd struggle to see why you wouldn't use JavaScript for most things.
I guess there's something about your enterprises kind of dumping the legacy and keeping with the times. And I was actually talking to a really interesting chap earlier in the week who was talking around how enterprises need to leave their legacy behind. And that's a very big thing for an enterprise to do when you've invested many millions of pounds in building core capabilities and systems that literally power the organizations, to turn around and say, hey, you know what, because tech has moved on and because there's something more modern, we need to get rid of that and start again. That's a big decision for any organization to take. But he was making the point to say that if organizations didn't do that and didn't modernize, then they would literally be left behind. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, 100%. It's you have to know why you're kind of upgrading your systems. So there are systems which you don't have to upgrade as frequently as others. But I mean, if you're talking about systems that have customers and end up on a web browser or on an iOS app or an Android app, actually, I think end users are going to be so frustrated by your tech that they'll end up just going somewhere else, and that by itself is a business reason to continuously upgrade your tech. I was listening to somebody the other day, and they were talking about how expensive good architecture is in a big organization like ours. And then he turned around and he said, well, if your architecture isn't right in the first place, it'll be so much more expensive. So it's always important. It's always important to kind of stay ahead of things and make sure that actually you're fit and agile for the future.
And you touched a few moments ago about on NPM packages, and we talked about your Express just being an NPM package. But surely for an enterprise, that is one of the biggest challenges, because you've got this way of introducing third-party packages, third-party code written by other people. I mean, there might be vulnerabilities, there might be malicious code. The packages might just not be maintained. How do enterprises manage that risk of kind of introducing those packages into their organization?
I think a few ways. I think We always run code vulnerability scanning for open source projects on our pipelines. So we make sure that we stay ahead of the game. If you're not doing that, I highly recommend you're running NPM audit. But I think also, look at who's using the packages. So make sure that your package is well maintained. It has high number of weekly downloads. It has constant commits. The latest version wasn't more than, say, 3-4 months ago. So you know that if issues are kind of coming up, there is a big community behind it to go and fix issues quickly. That's what I'd probably recommend. I mean, it's not an issue that's solely a JavaScript issue. I mean, we saw it recently with Java and Log4j. It can happen with any. It could happen in any project. And I think just take those steps and I think you'll be on top of things.
I guess the challenge is for an enterprise that, you know, engineers are literally the last line of defense. And a lot of the unintended consequences that happen, you know, within software, you know, people don't necessarily know about. They're not hidden. It's because someone's done something when they've written the application. You know, we were trying to get a growth business case out or trying to deliver something into production quickly because the organization need it. But actually, you know, non-technical users may not be aware that we've got, you know, a package in our code base that has a vulnerability or that, you know, isn't well maintained or that an engineer's, you know, simply taking a shortcut that, you know, in hindsight, we wish we hadn't taken. But I guess this all comes back to the fact that, you know, we're all human at the end of the day, right? And humans inherently make mistakes and, you know, we have to find ways to live with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, generally, I could say from my time here at GSK and at Boots, it's there's definitely no kind of cutting corners when it comes to the amount of compliance you have to go through to make sure that actually people's data is well protected and no one has access to it, etc. And it's well protected. I mean, that's definitely the first priority for us. Before kind of any deadlines or projects, etc. So, yes, there will be vulnerabilities, etc. But I think it's as an organization, it's all about kind of where your priorities lie. And I think working in healthcare, it's always kind of the patient and the end user always comes first. And that's always been. I mean, if you look at our Jira backlogs, etc. Whenever there is such an issue, that's the first to be remediated, because actually it's a big deal for us, and we feel that we're part of the community as much as anyone else. We're here for our patients first, and actually the business comes second.
And you mentioned a few moments ago your open source and how important that is to us, you know, because obviously we benefit from, you know, the various packages that kind of we use in our applications. And I think, you know, it's the importance of big enterprises, you know, reinvesting back into the open source community is huge, right? And actually getting behind some of these packages and making sure that things are, you know, well funded and that, you know, we can continue to develop and iterate them. Have you contributed to open source yourself? Is that something that you've got involved with in the past?
Yeah, I think the first time I contributed to an open source project was about 6 years ago, when I was using a test framework and I found a bug, and I was questioning myself whether it's me just using it incorrectly, etc. Right. And I thought I'll raise a PR, and it went through and got a whole loads of thank yous and thumbs up. So yeah, I was quite happy with it. I mean, yeah, I'd like to contribute a little bit more to open source projects, and I highly recommend anybody to do that. I think there's a big win in open source projects. I mean, it's a no-brainer for organizations to use open source. And anybody who hasn't been involved, I'd highly recommend you do that.
And actually, we've been talking about trying to extend that inside our organization, going back to, you know, the federated model that we've got with your different teams in different parts of the organization. You came to me a few weeks ago and were talking, you're very passionately about InnerSource. I mean, for folks that haven't come across that before, what is InnerSource?
InnerSource is all about using the best practices and establishments of open source-like cultures, but within your organization. And it's really, really good for big organizations. So ultimately, you have kind of three members when it comes to InnerSource. So you have the maintainer who contributes and looks after the project, etc. They're basically the owners or the authors of the code. You have the contributors, so anybody who's contributed something back to the project. And then you have the community members, so people who use the projects. They might be active in conversation or express their opinion about the project direction, but ultimately they're kind of the end users of your project. And actually we're trying to do that within our organization as well. So we have web teams who are fully JavaScript engineers. And we have API teams who also write all their code in JavaScript. And actually what we encourage is actually if the web team do need changes to any of the APIs that they're using, then actually they raise their own PR. It will then go to the maintainers to then approve and make sure that it's meeting their principles, patterns, and standards. But ultimately, it's a win-win for everyone because the web team will be able to get their change quickly. The maintainers who look after the project also get changes to their APIs for free, pretty much. All they need to do is make sure they look after it. And I'd say there's multiple benefits to this. So because everybody's contributing to a single project rather than just kind of one theme, bugs are fixed in pretty much no time. So the web team will look and find a bug. They'll quickly, because they're the end users, they'll quickly raise a PR, get that through quickly. The general quality of your code goes up because you have more people contributing and more people having a say. And I mean, it's also good because then you can take the projects in different directions. So I mean, the API teams might just kind of think about their own roadmap, etc. But because there's so many different contributors, it just opens the roadmap in different directions and different trains of thought. So for me, I'm a big fan. I think we've only just started implementing it. I think it's got good feedback so far. I've seen it work previously in different organizations. But it's all about kind of commitment and working together and making sure that you're all kind of aiming for the same goal.
And as you say, Mar, I mean, it is brand new to us, right? We have literally just started implementing it. So maybe in a few months' time, we'll come back around the loop again and have another conversation and see how InnerSource is working for us. But, you know, if anybody is listening to the podcast who has experience of using InnerSource or kind of, you know, implementing that within their organization, I think we'd both be really keen to hear from you. So please, you'll find us on LinkedIn, Twitter. You'll reach out and let us know, because I think it will be great to have a conversation so we can understand how it's working in other organizations and maybe some of the pitfalls we need to avoid as we go on our own journey towards that model.
Absolutely.
And, you know, Mo, I mean, you're obviously very close to the code, right? I mean, you know, we've been talking about some quite technical detail about JavaScript and, you know, and the things that you need to kind of be aware of as you kind of build net applications. But you kind of get to a point in your career where you're in a lot of organizations need to almost kind of make a decision whether you go down a management track or whether you stay in a highly technical track. How important do you think it is for engineering leaders to stay close to the code?
I think it's very important whether you decide to go down the management track or stay down the kind of hands-on coding track. It's very, very important to stay close to the code. I mean, the way tech changes, it's drastic. And we spoke about kind of ECMAScript 2015 and how that's already had 6 updates. I mean, as an engineering leader, I mean, your team relies on you to set the direction and to kind of bring everybody together to set principles, patterns, and standards. And actually, I think you'll struggle to set that direction and vision Even with the best engineers, if you have little idea of kind of what's going on under the hood, it's difficult because you're obviously kind of busy doing other things in a lot of your day. But I definitely think you should carve up some of your week just to kind of look at the code. If you can make changes, fix a few bugs, etc., definitely recommend it.
And I totally agree with you. I mean, it's something I found in my own career, because as you kind of develop and kind of go through different different roles, the organizations require different things of you, right? In terms of what they need you to kind of provide and what you need to do. But I mean, I still try to maintain personal projects. You know, I've got probably two or three different projects on the go that at some point in the future, I'm sure I will release and will actually kind of do something in the wild. But actually, for me, it's just about kind of playing with cool tech. And okay, I definitely couldn't write as good a code as you or the teams that we've kind of got working for us. But I still do regularly kind of just go into a code base and kind of have a look and kind of see what's going on. And I think for me, that's something which is incredibly important, because I want to be able to have a meaningful conversation with the people that work with me, to be able to say, hey, what, I've got an opinion on this stuff, and actually my opinion counts. I think that's one of the ways that I can get the best out of the engineering teams that work with me. I mean, maybe have you got some other examples of how you have managed to get the best out of the teams that are working with you?
Yeah, I mean, it's all about a culture of excellence. I think we spoke earlier about kind of standardizing pipelines and standardizing code and ESLint, etc. And actually, we did recently kind of take a step back and think, how do we nurture innovation but have standardization at the same time? And what we regularly run are kind of these guild sessions once a week or once every 2 weeks. And actually what those sessions bring about is they bring about positive change. So engineers will come and say, this is the way we've standardized and this is the way we're doing things. But actually, we think this is a better way. And actually, we all agree on it together and then change the way we do things. I think that's one way. And I think the other way is, I think big organizations have traditionally taken a top-down approach to kind of tech and what they're expecting from their engineers. And I think we took a step back and actually thought, well, what tech do we want to use, and what tech actually does meet the business need, kind of from a bottom up, and I think that's brought all the engineers together. So all the engineers are working on the tech they've decided they want to work on that achieves the business need, and it's really produced a culture of excellence within the whole engineering organization.
I think there definitely is a thing about empowerment, right? Because people want to be empowered to do a great job and actually to see problems and to fix issues. And I think personally, I'm only one person, so I'm one brain, one head, and I'm never going to have as much knowledge or as much creativity as all of the people that work with me. There's definitely people around me. If you put those people together, you're definitely going to have a greater output than I will ever have as one individual. So I'm constantly looking for ways that I can kind of push decision making further into the teams, to empower teams to be able to do their own thing, and I think that's so important. But it's equally difficult for enterprises in particular to take that mentality, because we're investing millions of pounds into some of these projects and into some of these things. There are investors that are knocking at doors that have to have their expectations met, but we really need to kind of help enterprises to let go and to almost kind of trust their people. I think it was Steve Jobs that said that if we we're not looking to empower people to tell them what to do or employ people to tell them what to do. We want to employ great people so that great people can tell us what to do. And I think that is never truer and so important for organizations to be successful in today's climate. Mo, if you could give yourself one piece of advice to help you with your career, what would that one piece of advice be? Maybe the piece of advice you would have given to your younger self.
Yeah, I think I do look at kids who have started coding from such a young age, And I am very, very envious that I wasn't in the same position. I mean, there's just so many resources out there, so many things to look at. I think if I did go back many, many years ago, I would have probably got involved in tech a lot sooner in my career, in my life. Generally, I think my advice to people of all ages, really, just kind of look on resources online. There's so many YouTube videos now that just weren't available when I was when I had just started looking at tech in my teens, and just kind of take it from there. If you do need any help, etc., just reach out to kind of engineering leaders. I mean, they're available all over the internet now. If you ever need me or Steve, etc., I mean, just poke us on LinkedIn, and we're here to happy to answer your questions.
I think that is something about the community generally, which, you know, I don't think applies to all industries, actually. But, you know, because it genuinely is a community, most people are really happy to have a conversation and to talk, right? And I do know that myself. You know, people reach out to me on Twitter and LinkedIn, and, you know, I have conversations and talk to people and kind of try and help. And I know I've done that myself with other people. That I've just kind of, you know, randomly, you know, messaged and said, hey, I read something you wrote, or, you know, I was interested in something you said, or whatever that might be. And it really does lead to some really meaningful and engaging conversations. So, you know, we would massively encourage everybody to do that. And I think collectively, by talking more, we can all raise the bar and hopefully do a better job in tech. Mo, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. Thank you so much for taking the time out. I hope you've enjoyed it. And I'm sure we'll get you back at some point in the future to talk more about some of the stuff that's happening that we're doing at Haleon as we kind of move down that journey and learn more about what's happening in healthcare tech. So thank you very much for joining me on the Engineering Leader today.